Hello, welcome to the Longshot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is Keri Louise. Keri is a seasoned comedian. She's been on Showtime, Oprah, Dr. Oz, Howard Stern, and many others. She's an author, and her husband is also a stand-up comedian. It's a great story. Here's somebody that I think you're really going to enjoy today. Here is Keri Louise. All right, I'm here with Keri Louise. We're talking in the pregame. I love this story because people don't talk about it a lot. People don't go into the origin of what, you know, and your husband's a stand-up comedian. You're a stand-up comedian. So I want to go back. I want to know, were you born and raised in New York? Let's start there.
I was born in Boston, like just outside of Boston. And that's where I started my career. And that's where I met my husband. And we together moved to New York. Like, we're going to be famous. That was, I don't even want to know. I don't even want to tell you how long ago it was. Over 25 years ago.
Okay, Boston, a very great, you know, comedy town. Or, you know, have you seen the great Boston stand-up comedian documentary with Colin Firth, how he said Boston's going to be my town and he's a New York guy and they almost like ran him out with pitchforks. You know that scenario?
I do not, but I know that Boston, there's so many, and we're like, we stick together, the Boston comics. We're like, hey, cousin, hey, sister, brother, sister, you know, and so do the Long Island comics. So if you look at all the famous people from Long Island and all the famous people from New York, I mean, we're head to head. I think Long Island beat us, but because I think tons of comics come from Boston, but it's a boys town. And I think that it definitely helped me get really, really good. So when I decided to move to New York, it wasn't like I was drowning. I was kind of just keeping up because Boston really, it's a college town. It doesn't let you be hacky. It makes you write well. The audience is smart, and so you are put to the test in Boston, which was great. So I don't hate Boston. I go back, still work in Boston. I think that, you know, it totally made me what I am today.
Absolutely,
which is Boston, nothing. But anyway,
for people, we're gonna want to get into like why you wanted to be a stand-up comedian. You know how young you were and all that. But people that don't think Boston is like Harvard. And like, you know, nice, you know, preppy kids. That's what I thought it was when I was in my early 20s. I went out there and then I slept at my friend's house. He was a DJ and his girlfriend. And all these are preppy looking kids. But she's like, Jesus Christ, John, you brought these friends over. I don't even know where they fucking from and all this shit. And like, I'm like, oh, my God, you guys are supposed to be like, you know, like New Englanders. You guys are like miserable out here because they're shoveling snow. They're just miserable. Yeah. You know, and you cut your teeth on that atmosphere.
Right. Yeah. So I basically made it to every gig, snowstorm or not. One of my stories is I kept on asking the guy, I'm like, look, I have to leave now. Like, you know, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I have to leave now. If are you still going to have we have a nor'easter. Are you still going to have, we're still going to have the gig. I'm like, all right. Drove, not white knuckle driving, my foot hovering over the gas. Like my butt was like totally bruised as if I worked out and done tons of squats. I finally get to the gig and he's like, oh, we canceled it. After I risked my life getting there. And my friend, good friend now, but I knew him, Gregory Carey. I just met him. Big, tall African-American guy, right? Huge and big muscles. And the guy, you know, sketchy booker, you know, he doesn't give a crap. Obviously, he doesn't give a crap about me. So, yeah, we canceled. So, and it was a week. That was Friday night. So it's a two shows. But we're going to have the show Saturday night. And I'm not driving freaking home. So he's like, I'll put you up. But you got to sleep together. You got to stay in one room. And I'm not going to get two hotel rooms. I didn't even know this guy. And I was young and naive. And I'm like, okay, yes, I don't want to ruffle feathers because I want to get more work. I should have put my foot down. Now, my younger self, I'll tell you, your younger self, no, you will get me another hotel. I am not sleeping with a stranger. Right. Anyway, we became best friends. Great, Keri. You have to look him up. He's like he's such a great comic. And he has been really influential in my whole life because he moved to New York a little bit before me. So when I moved to New York, he showed me the ropes, helped me get a place to stay, you know, great guy. But it could have been, that's a great story, but it could have been really bad.
Well, you made lemonade.
So. Right. But who, you know, that booker was really just disgusting. But anyway.
But that's the life of the comic. You work for peanuts. Everybody treats you like garbage. You know, and it's a big, you know, people just piling on top of each other. And
you stay in a comedy condo with God knows whoever, you know, they don't care. Yeah. And I'm, you know, and it's mostly guys. And they and back then when I first started was, you know, years ago, they didn't give a crap who you were. And they especially didn't give a crap if you were a woman.
How old were you when you said, you know what, I want to be a comedian. I think I got something here.
I'm youngest of four. So anytime I made my sister was 6 years older than me. So we were close really now, but my brothers, I think they made me who I am today because I had to prove myself to them all the time. No one would give me anything unless I made them laugh. And when I made them laugh, they just laughed, but they didn't think anything of it. I took it to the grave. I'm like, I made them laugh. And you know, that's something. And I played sports. I was a jock. I wanted to play all three sports in high school. So there was no room for drama. Plus the drama kids weren't the most popular. So I never wanted to do drama in high school, God forbid, but I secretly wanted to. But I was the cheerleader on the field hockey field, the baseball, basketball, all the sports I played. I was the cheerleader. I was standing up telling jokes, and during the stretches, I was captain. Everybody looked up to me. I said all kinds of stories. I made fun of all my teachers, and that was my stage time. I didn't realize it then, but now looking back, that because everybody's you must have been the state, you must have been the class clown. But no, because if I was the class clown, I would get in trouble and I couldn't play sports. If you get in trouble, if you get detention, you can't go to practice. Can't go to practice. You don't play. So I'm like, no way. So I let it out on the field and on the court. And in the traveling on the bus.
Nice. And that, strategic.
And that, yeah. And so looking back now, I'm like, oh, some of those jokes I said, that's how I started. When I went to college, I was like, I'm going to, you know, do something. I'm going to join the drama club in college. I still played field hockey. So I was still really busy. And every time I tried to do drama, it was packed because
where'd you go to college?
I went to college at Plymouth State in New Hampshire. It's now called Plymouth. It's now called University of New Hampshire at Plymouth.
And did you thinking, you know, I'm going to do stand up. Did you just stand up out there while you went to college? What was that
I
like?
Wanted to. Yeah. So what happened was I couldn't find a venue. I couldn't do drama. It wasn't really stand up that I wanted to do. It wasn't until my sorority was holding a beauty pageant. Now, I wasn't beautiful at all. I was very chunky, short hair, like short. My sorority letters were shaved in my head. That's how short my hair was. And I was chunky, but they were running a beauty pageant because it was a preliminary for Miss New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And Plymouth State was the one that was one of the preliminaries. So they needed contestants. I said, all right, I'll do it. And they need, and I'm like, what am I going to do for a talent? Well, I loved comedy. Do you know how people binge watch comedy? Well, back in my day, I binge watched VH1 and MTV because they had a comedy spotlight and all the comedy shows.
Right.
And I would at late at night just keep watching it and watching it and watching it. And I loved it. So I wrote 2 minutes and 30 seconds worth of material all by myself. Like I kind of knew that I shouldn't sample anybody's comedy, but I kind of wrote what I was saying on the bus, making fun of my teachers, making fun of my parents, all those things. It was kind of easy because I had been doing it in high school.
Right.
And I won.
Nice.
So there was three other people and they were guys. But anyway, no, I'm kidding. I won. I don't know how I won. But next thing you know, I'm representing Plymouth State in Miss New Hampshire pageant. And if I had won Miss New Hampshire, I would be going to Atlantic City and representing the state of New Hampshire in Miss America pageant.
Wow.
I didn't win. I won Miss Congeniality because no one was threatened by me. No one was threatened by me. My hair was still short. I, you know, didn't know anything about. I was in a pageant with JonBenet Ramsey types, tons, gorgeous, been doing it since day one, and I just made them all laugh, and they all loved me because, you know, they knew I was going to win.
Nice.
There was no animosity, and then the rest is history.
Well, let's get into that history. So, when did you start to say, okay, you know what? Now I'm going to start doing clubs. I'm going to do open mics. When did that start to happen?
So I graduated college soon after that, like 2 years after that. And then I'm like, well, I'm going to do this. And I went to school for teaching. So I kind of just subbed and waited till I got a job. And while I was waiting to get a job, I was doing open mics in Boston. I'm like, I'm going to do my first open mic was September in Boston, September 90, 1991. So
you waited long lines in Boston to get onto open mics.
Yeah, so I had to wait to get the open mic, but not wait in line. I had to call, and then I got on a list. It was like, 2 months I had to wait.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah,
That's
so I
good.
called as soon as I graduated. Yeah, I called as soon as I graduated in August, and in June, they gave me a September date.
Okay, that's pretty cool. So you didn't have to wait out there, because that'll just take all the
Oh, yeah.
creativity out of you.
And I didn't have to bring show. I didn't have to bring people. It was way before bringers, way before, you're going to just, it was a much better time. And it had a lot more. And comedy was booming. Actually, I came in right after the boom, which was in 80, the 80s. Like a lot of people that were just open micers were quitting their day job and they were basically headliners because comedy was, it was on TV. Then it got oversaturated. Right when I was coming in, it kind of got oversaturated by people just binging, which I think is happening now again. History is kind of repeating itself because Netflix is just putting out, you get a special and you get a comedy special and you get, and so Netflix is kind of oversaturating it. And I feel bad for the people that are coming up now. But anyway, I came up like right after the boom. It was still kind of booming. And I just kept on getting more and more gigs and less teacher opportunities. Then I was burning the candle at both ends and I chose comedy. I met Tom and I knew
Tom's
him
your
from quite a few
husband,
times.
right?
Yep, Tom Cotter. I met him.
How'd you guys meet?
We actually in New Hampshire. They sometimes don't pay you. They pay you in ski lift tickets. So they did that, and we were skiing the whole next day. And I said no more comics because I was kind of like dating comics. I'm like, I gotta date someone normal. It was hard to pick up when you're a woman comic. No one wants to talk to you. All the guy comics were like, "Hi, are you so funny?" And all the waitresses loved you. I got off stage. Everyone's like, "Don't talk to her. She's overbearing." So I would never get dates with normal guys. So it was New Year's Eve when we were performing, and I said my New Year's resolution was don't date a comic, don't date a headshot, date someone normal for God's sake. And I fell in love with Tom that day, and I was like, what am I doing? What am I doing? We skied together all day because no one else was out on the slopes, and we fell in love.
Most comedians, comedy set in the negative. There's a ne it's a premise with and a punchline with a negative denominator. That's the punch. So you're usually thinking premise punchline with a negative undertone to it. You do that all day long, and you're constantly writing material. Usually, you're going to end up with somebody that's might let that get their consciousness in a certain direction.
Yeah.
So the guys you were dating, now how did Tom, you said this guy, he's a good guy. He's not like one of those guys that has to live 24/7 as the basket case stand-up comedian, right?
Yeah. So I think one of the reasons why I fell in love with Tom so hard was because, first of all, his roommate had liked me. And so he said he wanted to make sure that it was okay for his roommate. So he basically called his roommate before he made any move. So it took a while for him to make a move. He wanted to make sure that he didn't break the guy code. And
Yeah, right,
I thought
sure.
that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And the stories that we told each other were his family stories were just like my family stories. Like he's youngest of six. I was youngest of four, and just our vacations, his vacations with his family, that were just as screwed up as the vacations I had with my family. I'm like, all right, I can handle this. And
Where's he from?
he's from Providence, Rhode Island.
All right, so you're both East Coast people. You're doing stand up. Where's his career at this point when you guys meet? Where's yours?
So he was a headliner, and again, he started out a little bit before me, so he was like right there in that boom, so he was able to get, rise quickly. And plus, I'm a woman, so no one would bring me, I swear, every time I say this to my husband, if I was a guy, I'd be way further than I am now.
You're working on, as a woman in stand up, is you're working on a harder gear.
Yeah, most definitely. So he was a headliner. I was basically opener feature, just starting to feature, working hard, making some money, not ready to really. I mean, I gave up my day job, but I was living with my parents, so that's why I was able to do that. But so when we moved to New York, we were still, we were big, sort of big in the Boston area. Everybody knew us, but when you go to New York, forget it. We were like little fish in a big, huge pond, and so it was tough. very difficult. I remember I was crying, like every day crying. New York was
Tell us
tough.
About, let's get into that point. That's where I want to go.
So yeah, we're going to go deep.
Was there a particular routine that you did one night at the comic strip or something, or like, let's get to the lowest point where you're like, I don't know if I should fucking do this anymore.
I was the lowest point. Yeah. I was living on a 6-floor walk up, because that's the only place we could afford 6-floor walk up. And I remember I was trying to get a day job. I was also a lifeguard. And so I tried to get that lifeguard job. And the guy put me through a test, like unbelievable, as if it was like an ocean job. It was a pool at a Y. Yeah. So he's timing me, speed timing me. And I didn't pass the speed time. I had to swim up and down. I'm like, it's a pool. You're not even supposed to jump in after these people and save them. You're supposed to throw them a life jacket. You're not supposed to jump in. It's a pool.
Yeah.
Timing me, I was totally exhausted. I didn't pass the test. And then I had to save a big, huge muscle man. I had to go in and save him.
That's part of your test.
Yeah, part of my test.
Overzealous HR guy at the YMCA.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I had to work my real job. I personal trained, and I had to go personal train, and I was late because I got lost. I couldn't find myself, and I couldn't get all the way downtown in time. And I said, I'm just going to go home. I forgot my keys. I lost my keys. I don't know. Everything was the worst day. Everything went. So I'm buzzing, praying to God Tom was home. I had a nervous breakdown in the foyer, buzzing the buzzer. And I just collapsed. I collapsed right there. And Tom carried me up. He was home, thank God. Carried me up 6 flights. Wow. And put me to bed and called the people and said, she can't make it. And I was like thinking about going home.
So that, yeah, you know, a lot of times a comedian will be like, I just bombed. And it's like, this is what it's about. But that wasn't it for you. There was just like the financial, the pressure of like, you know, going through all this bullshit, you know, walking up 6 flights, you know, and you're hitting at zenith at this point. But it really wasn't like, you know, as far as stand up was concerned, you felt good about, was there any low point you felt good about your career, or then you were?
Well, you know, well, that was the thing. I wasn't getting in any of the clubs either. Not right away. And financial, I was still going back to New York, Boston to work. So when I moved, I packed, gym packed my month, 2 months. I had 2 months of work. Like any comic, even the best of the best comics, if you look 3 months in advance in their calendar, they're unemployed. I don't care who you are. The best of the best. Even you would, a documentary that Joan Rivers had done, she said the same exact thing. I'm like, oh my God, me too. I'm just like Joan Rivers. but that's just how it is. So I did have work. So it wasn't about quitting. It was probably just like, maybe I'll move back home, because I still had work on the weekends, but I was barely surviving. I had to drive back up to New York, work on that weekend. It was so much more expensive in drive up back to Boston. So much more expensive in New York. Tom carried me a little. He helped a little, like he paid up, like if I couldn't make my car payment or whatever, he paid some of that for me. I always paid him back, by the way, because some months were tight. But I never really thought about quitting. It was just about how can I survive? Not like, how can I still do comedy and still live in New York and get another job? Or how can I still do comedy and eat?
Right. Let's talk about the big picture, because getting paid as a stand-up, you're not doing it for the money. You're going to get more money probably working at the Y than you would there, but you want to get your reps in. That's one, right? Now, as far as, I mean, how much, you know, getting more gigs, that's probably the segue from like going up at some of those key places. But as far as really, you know, financially growing in stand-up, do you have to, you know, what were the other modalities that you're thinking to go on your brain? So do I need to go on the road? Do I need to like, you know, go to LA to, you know, really get more exposure? Do I need to like, you know, really go on act, you know, auditions for acting, you know, cause just going out to the places you want to get the relationships built at those venues, but then there's another way to go around that. How are you navigating that? What would you do next? What would you, if looking back, what would you do differently? Let's talk about that.
Finally, got a name for myself. I got HBO Aspen Comedy Festival pretty early on, which was good.
The Comedy Festival, real quick. That's another avenue. That's where I'm getting at. So yeah, those are really good avenues that started in the early to mid 90s, the comedy festivals. I mean, there was a couple, but it really started to become more prevalent then. Was that really big needle mover for you?
Yes, it was. You know, Kathy Griffin, I'll never forget. She interviewed me for Access Hollywood at the time. And that was my first big TV credit. And that was at the HBO Aspen Comedy Festival. And I had a good manager. It was the same manager, Bill Burr. I was in the same pledge class as Bill Burr, Dane Cook, Bobby Kelly, tall Jewish guy.
Allman?
He
really
has
tall.
Tall, yeah, really tall. Gary Gulman.
Gulman, yeah.
These guys were all in my Patrice O'Neill, all in my pledge class. All those guys were the guys I started with. So me and Billy had the same manager at the same time, and we auditioned actually for the same sitcom. He got it, Townies, and I didn't get it. So I wish I had gotten it. I got beaten out by the girl who's on Gilmore Girls. She was in Townies, the mother on Gilmore Girls. Anyway,
but you were all in that same comedy festival together.
So I got the comedy festival. Bill maybe had gotten it a year after that, but he didn't get it the same time I did. But that helped me, you know, make a mark in that, you know, I'm here to play in New York. And it helped me get into many other gigs. And that manager, but here's where what I would do different. This is the only thing. This is like the just something that I look back. I try not to regret it at all. But my manager said, wow, this is great. And I had a great agent at the time. Let's go to this festival without any agents, see if you can get a better agent. But, and I didn't know, I didn't even know how to spell agent at the time. That's how young and naive I was. I'm like, okay. And I remember I was on the phone with five people begging me not to, and they wanted to make sure that I'm following what my manager said. And I go, yep, I'm going to follow what my manager said, and we want to get out of this contract. And they were sending me out on Ally McBeal auditions, like great auditions that I really wanted to be on. And so I said yes. I went to Aspen. I didn't get a better agent and hadn't since.
So you're saying you should have stuck with your agent.
Yeah.
You had an agent. You said, maybe I can get a better agent.
My manager advised me differently to get a better agent. And I trusted him.
I see.
I didn't get I hadn't gotten a good agent since then.
Right. And
I had good managers after that. I've had good managers after that, and I went to LA. To answer your question about LA or New York is where the work is, where comedy work is. So if you wanted to work in comedy and you wanted to still maintain that work ethic and be up every night of the week, if you wanted, New York is it. LA is not. LA, there was not much work. You had to really drive to get work. There was no real. Some coffee houses, but not really. But in New York, that you could work every night of the week if you wanted to. But
I mean, you got the Comedy Store, and you got Comedy Store, Laugh Factory, Improv in L.A. But out in New York, you know, there's like twice as many, you know, venues, and more people going out to these
plus tri-state area. You can really, you know, have a living of doing fundraisers and PTA meetings and all that stuff. Like, it's everywhere. Not so much in L.A. at the time. So we decided, you know, we'll just go out there during pilot season when pilot season was a pilot season. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, Tom and I went out there for pilot season. I had the same manager as Tim Allen, and Tom had the same manager as Ray Romano. Plus, we had pretty good, he had a pretty good agent at the time. We went out there for a pilot season for 3 months. We were paying two rents, mm-hmm. mine in LA, and then we had just gotten married. We went out there for 3 months. You would think with those people for management, we would definitely come home with some form of a pilot or something. The only thing we got was pregnant.
Okay, nice.
We were bored. Seriously, that is a true story. We were bored. We were bored all day long. We had nothing to do, so we decided, hey, let's.
Were you going on auditions or you know, just you know.
It was just a little auditions here and there. We were working at night. They got us into the clubs. That was nice. We were working at night. Not really that many auditions during the day. I don't know why. Just it wasn't in the cards for us. I'm not sure. I auditioned for a few things. And then the only thing I got out of it, too, was Last Comic Standing. And they weren't even looking for me in L.A. When we had message services before, like big time cell phones, we had message services. They called my message service in New York. We want to see if you can come in tomorrow. I'm like, I'm in LA. They're like, okay, well, you can audition in LA. So my manager didn't even get me that. I auditioned for Last Comic Standing, and that's really where my career kind of took off after that.
Wow. Okay. So
and then I couldn't do that. I did the pilot for Last Comic Standing. I found out I got the pilot for Last Comic Standing the day I found out I was pregnant with twins.
Right. And that there lies the inciting incident of your career. At this point, you get pregnant, and then, you know, because you're going to the tri-state area, you're going to those places, you're traveling. What is this now? Tell us, you know, how do you navigate this? How does that change everything? You know, what tell us what happened there?
So, like I said, we came home from after our stint for doing the pilot season and for 3 months. I had a feeling I was pregnant, but I didn't want to know for sure because Tom had to leave earlier than me. I had to stay. I actually had to move my ticket to audition for Last Comic Standing. So I moved my ticket, do Last Comic Standing. I think that's the reason why I got the job. I was so busy thinking, oh my God, I think I'm pregnant, that I didn't care about the audition. And I wasn't focused on the audition. Like, I'm going to ruin it. You know, I wasn't in my head. And so I got home from LA and I said to Tom, we're going to get the pregnancy test together. So we'll wait till I get home in New York. I got home and we got tested. I'm like, oh my God, I'm pregnant. Great, great, great. I'll get a doctor's appointment the next day. I got a doctor's appointment the next day I got a doctor's appointment. He tells me I'm pregnant, not only pregnant, but I'm pregnant with twins. Freaking out. I walk out of the office going, oh my God, I was just, you know, just wanted to make sure that I was pregnant. Now I have twins. I'm freaking out. The phone rings. No lie. My manager, guess what? You got the pilot. They want you to come back in a week to film the pilot of Last Comic Standing. I'm like, okay. And so I didn't tell him I was pregnant. I was going to say that because it was just so early on, 2 weeks, anything could happen, especially with twins. They said anything can happen. So I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do the pilot. I do the pilot. And a year later, they finally sold the show. So I did the pilot. I got paid for the pilot. They revamped it, tweaked it. That's how people do things. And they finally came up with Last Comic Standing. It was called Comic House when I did the pilot, by the way. Then they call it Last Comic Standing. And I couldn't do the first episode because I just gave birth. I just given birth.
Okay. So
I did the second episode. My twins were two. I did it. My husband did it. And I went to the finals. And I beat my husband.
Wow. So how much time, how do you navigate that? How does that work? Because first of all, I mean, twins, no less, you know, and then your husband needs to go on the road a little bit. He needs to do his routine, you know, but, and you're doing your thing. How do you take care of the kids? I mean, how does this all work?
I called my parents. I called his parents for like overnight, real big weekend overnights. If we had them, I had an entourage of, thank God I have a great neighborhood that I'm living in that I help. I was home a lot during the day. So I helped my neighbors. And when I had to go away for the weekend, my neighbors helped me. And I had babysitters galore. A lot of times the phone would ring and it would become a math problem. Like, is it going to pay my babysitter? Is it going to move the needle in my career? How far away is it? Do I have to stay overnight? Am I going to be up all night and then up at 6 to feed the babies? Can I do this gig? And a lot of times it was no. Where the phone would ring with Tom and he was like, yep, I can do it.
Let alone writing your material and then honing it in the mirror and all that other little crap that, you know, comedians do. I mean, where do you find time? I mean, were you burning candles at both ends?
Burning, like, candles, were you getting any sleep? Yep. Yeah. I remember I would put my kids on a regimen, a routine. They would go to bed at 8. That's when I would, you know, sit down and start writing and make phone calls and emails. And a lot of times I couldn't go on those cruises weekends, Thursday through. I would do PTA fundraisers and any type of things in and out, like tri-state area, go into the city. I was constantly still showing my face in the city. And in that time I wrote my book. I wrote two books, Mean Mommy, and I wrote a children's book. And then that's when I started to, how can I still show my face without, you know, actually getting clothes on and going out the door? And that's when I said, you know, I'll do like a little sitcom, like something, anything that happened during that month, I would collect like mommy things that happened with the kids. And then I would recreate it. And it was called My Mommy Minute. And I had, I did it for 9 years, once a month for 9 years. And it was just all just like funny things that just had happened during that month, and all these moms could relate. I got all these people on my mailing list, and I would send out a newsletter, and every time I sent a newsletter out once a month, I would send that little clip, and it was like a little sitcom, a 5-minute sitcom. And I was thinking, you know, that, and I would send it to industry and showcase and all that stuff, and show that I'm a content creator before content creator was really a thing.
What year was this?
I did it when the kids were 2, so they're almost 20 now. Wow. And I did it when the boys were, so it was about.
You look fairly until young, the kids are 20. I mean, you're doing all right, you know, being a stand-up comedian and, you know, being in smoke-filled room. Well, not smoke-filled in rooms anymore, but yeah.
Yeah, but it was when I first started. And I was doing it before content creator was a thing. And right. But I wanted someone to see me. I wanted someone to see my story and say, oh my God, this is a sitcom. Look at this girl. This is so funny. And I look at it now and it's still real funny stuff. I'm trying to use those mommy minutes that I did and trying to now put it on a different platform, which everybody's at TikTok in 30 seconds. And, you know, so I'm trying to recreate how I can, you know, get that triangle now to fit in the hole that it is today, because it's happening so fast. It's changing. Once you like finally learn this TikTok thing, it's going to be something different. You know, right. Everything's going by so, so, so fast. So anyway, so that's what I decided to do. Like, here's how I can show my face and still be relevant and still use this creativity that I have to get out. So, and I loved writing, and I loved editing my own stuff. It became like a new way of writing, because I would edit it. Like, I got a punch. The timing was different. Like, I would like, all right, cut right here, right at the timing. And then here comes the punchline. So that was a different passion. And I think that, you know, I think a lot of comics have to always, you're constantly redefining your passion for this business, or else you're just going to be bitter. Because things change really, really fast. And if you can't change with it, then you're just going to be a bitter comic. And no one's funny when you're bitter. So I think I'm doing that a lot. I'm constantly redefining my passion and, all right, I'll be doing this for a little bit. I'll be doing this for a little bit. And a lot of times I feel like I missed the mark a little, but it's all for a reason. There's a divine timing for me at some point, and I'll get there when I get there.
You got to really have a Zen-like attitude if stand-up comedy is going to be your career, because not everybody's ending up with a Seinfeld kind of scenario. Now, let's go back to this book. When did you write the book? Because that shows something right there. It's an interesting time. You know, if you're thinking about it, it's like, I got to do something. If I can't go out, you know, was that when you were pregnant, like in the third trimester? Or when did you start writing this book, and when did you finish him, the first one?
It took me quite some time, because I was just trying to figure out, you know, how I could get it
published. The book right there. Look at that. So. Okay. So it says Mean Mommy. She's wearing some combat stuff, you know, and you got like, you got some broccoli in the left hand.
What's that? I'm going to shoot you with a squirt gun, a Nerf gun.
Yeah. She got a bunch of like kids toys in her camouflage pants there. Oh, and then you got cross-eyed, you know, on the back, you got your cross-eyed picture with your army hat. Oh, and then the whole family there. Look at those. You got 3 sons, a dog, and you guys look fresh.
My husband, who's a comic, and he's basically my 4th son. So
you don't look like a quintessential stand-up comedy couple, because you guys look fresh. Your kids look fresh. You know, usually, just saying, especially when you're the East Coast, you know, because comedy, you know, stand-up has a way of beating the shit out of you. You know, you look like, but you guys look all right. You look like the modern day, be doing a Toyota, you know, minivan commercial in that picture.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was the first and last time I would spend that much money on a family photo shoot.
Yeah.
No, we'll never look good this good ever. Here's how it started out. I was writing for a little column in a parent magazine called Dirty Laundry. So that was once a month. And so I kept all those stories. It was a story that I would write, you know, what happened to me this time. And I would just like give you the whole Dirty Laundry spiel of, you know, what happened, how it is when you wake up and you don't want to feed the baby and arguing with your husband. And I would always make it funny. So this is basically what it was, a collaboration of all that stuff. So I had a bunch of that stuff already, and they since got rid of the article. And I'm like, you know what? I have all this stuff. Let me turn this into a book. And so it's just basically, Mean Mommy is basically, it's the tip, you know, the trials of surviving through the comedy trenches and having three kids and a husband who's always on the road. And then every once in a while, I'll give you a little bit of like some advice, like, this is what I did. This is what the doctors aren't going to tell you, but this is what I did. You know, just basically trust your instinct and get back to the basics. We're going to, you know, I think that we need more mean mommies and mean daddies in this world. You know, and everybody is going to get a trophy and you're going to eat your broccoli or you go right to bed.
Well, that's perfect. Now, I'm curious, where are you at right now? Post-COVID, things opened up a little bit. You know, I mean, in LA, they're opening up a little bit. Everywhere else has opened up a lot. You know, where are you at right now with you in your career?
You know, it's just starting to... People are just starting to start booking in the future, but before they were not booking in the future. They didn't know what the future was. So I would get a booking here and there. I would get lots of Zooms booking, which was horrible. I hated Zoom. But
did you do the car thing with the honking and the and
yes,
the
drive, I did the drive car outside. Yes, and the honks, which I thought was going to be really bad, but the one I did was really, it was actually fun.
People Real quick, that's amazing. The Zoom and the drive-in theater stand-up thing, I think that adds to the acumen and it adds to the martial art of comedy to round out your skill set. What did you learn from that drive-in, you know, stand-up show?
I didn't really learn anything. I mean, people were just happy to get out of the house. Zooms, the only thing good about Zoom was they all have positive emojis. Like, I would hate to get heckled by a middle finger.
Look at that. She's giving me, as we're talking, we're on Zoom, and she's giving me all these emojis, like the thumbs up and the clap and the confetti thing. And that's and what so, people did when you're doing that. And you're and like, oh, okay.
Right? Because it would be so bad if I got heckled by a middle finger. But it Zooms, the only good thing was that is I loved the commute. I didn't even have to, you know, put on pants. You know, it was nice. I just blew dried like this half of my hair.
Right.
And getting ready for a gig took 2 seconds. I threw on a shirt and then same with my husband. He's like, he did a Zoom. I had to do a Zoom. We were done. We were in bed by like 9 o'clock. It was amazing.
How many people you got in a Zoom meeting for those Zoom things?
I had to do one too early in the morning because it was across the world. So that was great too. I was doing business meetings with people who were in China. And
but
so
this is a stand-up. We're talking a stand-up routine.
So I've done them just mostly I was doing them just alone. A couple of times I had other people on the show. And then there was a couple of pages, like 50, you know, people.
Wow.
Sometimes I didn't know there was way more than that. It depends. Depends.
Did you have a backdrop that would at least look like a stage or something?
Yeah. Green thing, green screen. And
oh, you did
we
green
had a
screen.
Studio. We set up a studio that was always there and our notes were on the right. That was what was so good too. I never forgot a joke because all my notes were right there.
Oh, that's cool.
Stuck up on the computer.
That's great. All right. So now what's going on now? What, you know, are you going out now? What's happening?
So I'm working.
Hey, there's your little son right there.
My son.
He's part of your audience. Hey, let's get him in here. He's right there. Let's ask him a question. Which son is this? What's this young gentleman's name that we're talking to?
I'm Tommy.
Tommy, you want to be a stand-up comedian?
I don't know. It could be something in my future, like a side job or something.
You know, mom and dad, or you know, do you have any inherent, you know, a material off the bat? You could talk about how your parents are stand-up comedians. That'll screw with your head a little bit in a good way.
Yeah. I think I'm like kind of funny. Like I think I'm funny. My friends think I'm funny. So.
I think he's got the 40-yard stare of a comedian already. You know, look at him. He's got
You know, my husband and I worked at my son's college. Both my twins go to the same college, URI, and we did Parents Weekend together. And I asked my twins if any of them wanted to introduce me, and Harry said he did. And so Harrison did like 3 minutes of stand-up, and he introduced me, and he said, Mom, I love that.
Oh, good.
And I was like, oh, no.
Here's the thing. All you ladies and gentlemen listening out there, about stand-up comedy can be great, even if you know, you do it for a while, but it's good for public speaking. First of all, you have to talk about, you know, a lot of the, you know, things that you have to appeal to people. You have to have rapport with the audience. There's a lot of good things that, you know, if you want to do stand-up, that's great. But also, it'll help you write a book, like Carrie did. I'm going somewhere with this. And it also helps you with business, you know, and indirectly.
Yeah, he's a communications major, so.
Yeah, yeah. Now, where's your husband at now? Now, let's talk about difficulties in the relationship with two comedians in the same house. You know, what are those arguments like?
Well, yeah, everybody asks that question. And I always say, you know, we're married. We're a normal married couple. We hate each other just like everybody else.
Right.
But if we were to get divorced, he can have the kids in the house. I want my jokes back.
So you're giving him a lot of material. Now he gives you tags. You give him tags.
And he gives me a lot of material too. We've given each other so much material. It's been so long. We don't know whose material is who wrote what. But he'll say he wrote everything. But no, it's not so true. And you know what's so funny is, like, I'll do a joke and it won't go as well because I'm a woman. And I'll give it to him. I'm like, see what happens if you say this joke. Applause break.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
You know what's great about this relationship, though, because, I mean, you could attest for this. You see all those comedians, like that brick wall outside the Comedy Store, all those comedians that are hanging out there. You know, they're talking about each other's routines usually, or they're cracking jokes. And they say, you know, I can't use this, but you know, it'd be good for the routine. I saw you do it. You know, it'd be good for you to do that. Now you have an in-house, you know, writing partner, you know, so you guys help each other get, you know, tags and possible punchlines for your material, right?
Like dibs, I got it. Dibs. And, right. You know, if something really happened, I'm like, oh my God, that's funny. And like, sometimes we'll think of it as at the same time and we'll be like, oh no, I got it. And then we'll write it and you know what? We'll share it. We've been married so long. Like no one even cares. If it's like really good, 9 out of 10 times, if we write it together and he does it, he gets a bigger laugh. It's just, that's the nature of the beast, unfortunately.
And that sucks, but there should be like some type of unspoken law. You can never steal material, but if you're married to somebody, it's community property.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've been married way over 7 years. So
yeah, that you have a right. You guys should say, you know what? I saw the wife or the husband, they did that. It's like, you know what? They're married. That's fine.
Yeah.
And you both signed off on that. I think that's fair.
I think so too. And he's doing a big event, like for the Catholic community, has to be squeaky clean. I'm like, all right. And I just gave him, I go, here, you can do some of this Catholic stuff. And as I was telling him all my Catholic stuff, I'm like, that's clean. You can do that. Just switch it to, you know, my wife instead of my husband. And I go, you know what? You wrote half that bit anyway. So it's basically yours. That was our conversation this morning. He's like, yeah. No wonder I like that bit.
Future. What's on your 5 to 10? What do you see yourself? You know, what does that look like for you?
Well, I wrote a show that I'm really proud. I wrote a lot of shows. I wrote a sitcom for me and my husband called The Monday I Love Lucy. I would really love to pitch that. Right now I'm pitching this one show. It's a reality show. And it's been in a couple of networks. And it's a reality show that Tom and I would host. And I would really want to just sell it. If they even don't want Tom and I to host it, I think it's a great, great, great show. I'm hoping that will sell and maybe I can be in the behind the scenes, but I truly want to be a season regular, a series regular on a sitcom.
That's it. That's always, you know, it's a lot of always 90% comedians want that.
Yeah. And sitcoms are, I don't even know if they even exist anymore.
Right. Well, yeah, maybe series on Netflix, Hulu, you know.
Hulu, but, yeah. Anywhere. I even love dramatic acting too. So that's where I really, now that my kid is older, pretty soon he's going to get his license. I don't even need to, you know, even be here. So I'm trying to really hone in now. It's like my turn.
Yeah.
The pot is moving to the front burner and I'm going to really make a name for myself. That's where I see it. That's where I mean, and now I'm still juggling. You know, I'm working in Long Island this weekend. It just so happened. I'm working in Pennsylvania and Long Island. It just so happened that he has a lacrosse tournament in Long Island. I'm praying to God, this woman, last week, I just gave him to this woman. She goes, I'll take him. I don't even know her. I'm like, okay, thank you so much. Because I was working. He had a tournament someplace else in the middle of nowhere. And thank God she was such I met her like, and I just gave on the side of the highway. I was on my way to a gig. She was on her way to the tournament. So thank you so much. And she's going to drive him this time. I'm going to Pennsylvania. I'm going to meet him late at night in Long Island. He's going to do the tournament. I'm going to go do my gig in Long Island, and then he's going to do the next day tournament. So I just so happened. So that's great. I'm actually going to be there, and I can actually see him. But that's what I'm doing. I'm juggling and constantly.
These are the nuts and bolts of stand-up comedy, of the reality. This is what the working stand-up comedian has to do, and a lot of comedians, choose a life of, which is amazing, because you chose a life of getting married. There was when I was took some time where, cause I'd done stand-up off and on since I was 19, every 5 years. Okay. I'm going to just do it. Like, and then it was like, I think it was like, it was my mid thirties and I really started just kicking ass. I mean, I was like, the pitches start to slow down. You know what I mean? And you're hitting them out of the park, everything slows down. Cause when you're not doing what you're doing in anything, things move fast. And then I realized, I'm like, wait a second, I got a company, got family. Am I going to go on the road? What's that relationship going to be like? And then, it's hard to juggle it. You made Lemonade, you wrote some books and all that, but this is a tough gear, but it's a really fulfilling life when that's your cause celeb. It's in your DNA, it's in your heart, and that's what I also want to get to for the denouement of our conversation here at the end. When you think about when you're older, when your audience pool is like Jerry Seinfeld says, it's gotten smaller, do you see yourself doing stand up at a ripe old age? What does that look like for you when you get older? Do you want to do this forever? What does that look like?
Yeah, like I would love, I could definitely be the Joan Rivers, doing the stand-up, still being in front of the camera, a couple of movies here and there, or even TV, sitcoms, dramatic acting. I definitely want to do all that as well. Have some movies and also TV shows that I've written and have other people perform. And still, yes, I still want to do that, go out whenever I want to, fly my private jet, go do a show just for me, and then come back. I feel that is my therapy. That's why I'm a better mother. And if I don't have that, I won't be able to survive. So I will never retire.
Well, this is the pedigree. So this is the work ethic.
I'm going to do stand up in my own funeral.
Good. And this is, I love that. And this is, you have that East Coast lunchbox mentality, that pedigree that you've built up, telling me your whole story. I love that. And you just, and you're still, you're starting to take your material and your new material and TikToking it, and you're going to keep on doing that. And it's funny, you work really hard to put yourself in gratuitous situations. And that seems like that's what you're doing. So really great. I love it. Please tell everybody how they can find out more about you.
So you can find me on all social medias called Kerry Louise Comedy. Spell my name with an I, not the Y, because you'll get the porn star. That's a different form.
Is there a Kerry Louise? A Kerry Louise? Yeah. All right, let's be careful. That's K-E-R-R-I.
Yeah.
Louise.
L-O-U-I-S-E. Comedy. Mm-hmm. And my books are sold on Amazon. I also wrote a book for children. It's called Harry the Elephant Has an Allergy.
Wait, one more time. What's the title again?
Harry the Elephant Has an Allergy. Nice. It's about an elephant allergic to nuts, peanuts, and he meets a cow allergic to milk, who meets a chicken allergic to eggs, and it goes on and on and on. And I'm so proud of that book because I published it myself, and mm-hmm. I hired an illustrator who's also a stand-up comedian. And the illustrations are just as funny. And it's just a funny, cute little children's book that helps normalize allergy. And it helps start the conversation of, what to do when you know someone who has an allergy and how to normalize it and make it fun and not difficult.
Kerry Louise, thank you so much for sharing your story. Anybody that listens, serious, stand up or watches a Netflix special or just sees stand, and then to find out, hey, I've had two kids, I've written these books, and my, you're living the life of a stand-up comedian with your husband, this is the nuts and bolts of that lifestyle. And I wanted to display that today and you delivered. So thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you. Yeah. Keep plugging away. And Thank you for asking me to be on your show, because you're constantly in this career, you know, struggling or calling yourself a struggling artist. I'm a struggling artist and struggling to do this, struggling to do that. And you don't really see the wins. So you helped me see the wins today. And there are some.
I love this story. I love it. You know, I mean, I have personal, you know, background in that, you know, and a passion for it, but this is, it's, there's a lot of people out there that end up doing something, you know, more often, like I'd say 95% of society is driving. If they're listening to this podcast, they're like, you know, I wish I was doing something else, or I always wanted to do that. And the life of a long-term stand-up comedian, you know, is like, they took that route and they're doing what they want to do. And they're, and I got to tell you, there's really not much, something much better than hearing, you know, 100 people in a nice, cool, low ceiling, you know, room, laugh at your shit. It's just really wonderful. It's great affirmation. And no one's making them laugh. It's just you and that microphone. And I just love, I love the fact that you live with, a stand-up comedian, and you guys met that way. And I love the fact that you wrote two books with your kid. It's just a lot of learning to be there. So you have a great story. So it was very easy for me to, you know, seek you out. And then when I saw your story and saw, you know, more about you, I was like, yeah, this is I think you have a lot of value for to give, you know, so thank you for sharing it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pleasure. That was seasoned stand-up comedian Keri Louise, making it happen, whether she's married, having kids, writing books, whatever. Here's the perfect quote for her. 3 out of 4 marriages end in failure. If you're going skydiving and they told you 3 out of 4 parachutes won't open, would you still fucking jump? Bill Burr. Thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hanging out with you all in the next episode. All right, have you guys been to longshotleaders.com? That's where you can check out all of the guests and the bios and the backgrounds and more. Also, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we do, give us a good rating. Tell your family and friends to come by and listen. It's going to make you feel nice and toasty inside. Every week we'll be delivering knowledge, creativity, inspiration, exasperation, perspiration. If it ends with a shun, basically you're going to find it here. All right, thank you for joining us. And in the great words of Bill Murray in the movie Caddyshack, friends for life, I say.